Listen, House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Rep. Johnson.
Present.
Rep. Edelson.
Present.
Rep. Feist.
Present.
Rep. Grossel.
Present.
Rep. Hollins.
Present.
Rep. Hewitt.
Present.
Rep. Cleavorn.
Present.
Rep. Long.
Present.
Rep. Lucero.
Present.
Rep. Mueller.
Mueller present.
Rep. Novotny.
Novotny present.
Rep. O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
Rep. Pinto.
Present.
Rep. Poston.
Present.
Rep. Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Rep. Vang. Rep. Vang. Rep. Sean.
Present.
And that concludes roll call.
Thank you. A quorum is present. Thank you, Mr. Abdullahi. Quorum is present. Members, let's do the minutes. Representative Sean, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of March 3rd?
So move, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Members, discussion? Rep. Johnson, we're okay. Voice vote, I assume.
That would be fine.
Thank you, sir. All in favor of adopting the minutes of March 3rd of this committee, please say aye.
Aye.
All same side. Motion prevails, and the minutes are hereby adopted. Members, a quick reminder, the next time we meet will be Tuesday. It's going to be a long day. We will meet at our regular time at 1, and then we will recess and then reconvene at 6 p.m. We have 6 to 10 scheduled. I'm hoping it won't take till 10. It is the one big day when we will try to get a number of bills sent to us acted on, at the very least heard, so that we can make our committee deadline. I will not make a habit of evening hearings. My hope is not to have another one, but you never know. But I just want to make sure I give everybody a heads up. Today's today's theme is Post-Conviction and Relief Day. We have two bills before us, both by Representative Long, so we'll keep you busy, busily engaged, Representative Long. Members, the intent is to lay the first bill over, and then we will be voting on the second bill on a motion to the Judiciary Committee. But the first bill, we'll have a conversation, hear from testifiers, and then it'll be my intent to lay that bill over for possible inclusion. So with that, the chair calls forward House File 3464 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Long, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an author's amendment I'd like to move, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Representative Long moves the A1 amendment. Representative Long, tell us quickly what this is.
Sure. This is some technical feedback that we received to the posted language, so it doesn't change the intent of the bill, but it clarifies some of the procedures.
All right. Seems like a typical motion for us to shape the bill in the form the author has it before us. Representative Johnson, I think a voice vote should be suffice. What do you think?
That would be fine.
Very well. Discussion on the A1 amendment? All right. All in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 3464 as amended is before us. Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to make sure my testifiers have the link to join. First, I just wanted to wish the committee a happy Second Chance Week. We had Second Chance Day on Tuesday with some great conversations with our constituents and others. today's bill that we're hearing first deals with pardons. And we know that pardons are the opportunity for societal redemption, a reflection that an individual has truly succeeded in rehabilitating and turning their life around. It can mean new opportunities for jobs, for personal freedoms, and more. It can also mean enhanced self-esteem and dignity for those individuals. Yesterday, we heard a personal journey taken by Samantha Hygis to receive her unanimous pardon last year. And I think this is a good reflection that pardons are the quintessential second chance for Minnesotans. This bill would modify the pardon process in two ways. First, it would create a clemency review commission. Right now, the workload for reviewing pardons falls to three of the busiest people in the state, the governor, the attorney general, and the Supreme Chief of the Supreme Court. Petitions to the pardon board have increased 250% in the last few years alone. Last year, the board received 161 petitions. This commission would help screen petitions that are coming up to the pardon board and make recommendations to the full board. The board would still retain its full discretion in terms of which petitions to grant, but this would be a much better process for making sure that we are giving fair consideration to those individuals who are seeking pardons in our state. The second change the bill would make is it would respond to the state Supreme Court's Shifa decision last year, when the court made clear that the question of what the state constitution means by saying the governor may grant a pardon in conjunction with the Board of Pardons is a decision for the legislature to decide. The court noted that there are multiple interpretations of what this language means, and that it is currently unclear what the Constitution requires in that regard. So that leaves it to the legislature to make a determination about how that constitutional provision should be answered. So this bill would use the straightforward answer that the language means the governor plus one other member of the Board of Pardons can grant a pardon. It's a very high burden to have three individuals agree unanimously on a pardon. And indeed, it puts us as an outlier in Minnesota with the other states across the country. Minnesota's approach is stricter than all but six other states in the country in terms of how we approach pardons. So this, I think, would be a fair process. It would certainly be consistent with the state constitution, as the Supreme Court made clear over the summer. And I think would be a way to help ensure that we are not putting such a high burden as we currently have on our pardon process. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have three testifiers who I'd like to invite to speak to the committee.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Long. First, we have Professor Mark Gosler. Professor, good to see you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Sure, and thank you, Chairman. My name is Mark Osler. Last name is O-S-L-E-R. I'm a former federal prosecutor. I currently serve as the Robert Marion Short Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of St. Thomas. I also, even though I'm a doctrinal professor, I have a clinic where we do clemency cases in the federal system, mostly commutations. My experience is not just in Minnesota, but across the country, and I've been part of discussions across administrations. And one of the things that's really struck me about clemency is, and this is looking at the state practices as well as federal practices, is that it's one of the rare areas of bipartisanship across this country. It's been seen as not a red or a blue issue, but something that is important to people across the spectrum, sometimes for different reasons. For some, it's about fairness. For libertarians, it can be about the limits of government action and how we have to allow people to escape from the strictures of government sometimes. And for some, and this includes myself, it's a faith imperative. It's one of the few areas where the faith, my own Christian faith, but also members of other faiths, there has to be a role for mercy. There has to be a role for tempering sometimes the undue harshness of criminal law. When we look at other states and what's happening, what we see is that, in fact, it's Republican-led states that do the most in clemency for the most part. Right now, for example, when we look to Oklahoma, we see Governor Stitt there granting 774 clemencies in his first year in office, compared to our state's between 20 and 40 each year. Historically, in modern times, one of the most productive governors for clemency was Mike Huckabee in Arkansas, who regularly granted hundreds. Among modern presidents, if we look back to 1980, the president with the highest grant rate for clemency is Ronald Reagan. So this isn't something that is a partisan issue. And when I work on this issue nationally, my partners include Paul Larkin at the Heritage Foundation. The people I've talked to about this include former Attorney General Edwin Meese. In fact, I often find I get much more traction on that side of the aisle than I do amongst Democrats. So in Minnesota, when we look at what has happened with our system, and is that there's really a couple problems that Representative Long already described. One is that we have a pipeline that's very narrow. We can't consider many cases, and that's because everything has to appear personally in front of the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice of the Supreme Court. This is a pretty unique system. Only Nebraska comes close to doing something like this. And it's certainly an extraordinary spectacle to watch people come and make their case in front of those three officials. It's something that's really intimidating, too, to the average citizen. But it does limit the number of cases that can be considered. And we're seeing a rise in the number of cases. And so this is going to be a problem going forward. We also have the problem of the unanimity requirement in the current statute. It places a lot of filters on granting of clemency. And that's been, and this isn't something we're looking at it, we're just looking at the present system. But historically, regardless of the makeup of the board, we see a real reluctance to grant clemency, even in strong cases, because of this unanimity requirement. Now, another issue is that we have kind of artificial device, the pardon extraordinary, that is really, there's nothing extraordinary about it. It's a regular pardon, and that can be combined with pardon, and this can be simplified. That's part of what happens with this bill. But let's talk about the solutions that are offered here. To solve the pipeline problem, the bill creates a clemency review commission. And this is something that we see in really high functioning systems, including if we look right next door to South Dakota, that there they have a commission that advises the governor, who then makes the decisions. And we've rooted mechanism in what we see in South Dakota. We had conversations with the members of the board there. And this commission would go ahead and, sorry, someone just came to my door. This commission would review the petitions. They wouldn't make the decisions. They'd make a recommendation to the board. And when they had hearings, of course, these could be videotaped and the board members could review those. In terms of the change in voting, it would change it to the governor plus one other member of the board. Now, going back to, I want to talk about the Schieffa opinion briefly. The constitutional provision that creates this power is Article 5, Section 7. The governor, which sets out that the governor, in conjunction with the Board of Pardons, has the power to grant reprieves and pardons. And that phrase, in conjunction with, is what the Supreme Court in the Schieffa case found was ambiguous. It's just not clear on the face of it what in conjunction with means. Now, they said, really, there's two ways you could look at this. It could be that the governor alone can just ignore the rest of the board and make a decision. And that's the first possible interpretation. The second is that the governor has to involve the board in some way in making that decision. And they found that it's the second. They resolved the ambiguity by saying it's the second that is more in keeping with the history of that constitutional amendment that put that into the Constitution. And so when they looked at that, what they said, what the Supreme Court said in the Schieffer opinion, is that under that second sense of what this constitutional provision would mean, there's two things that can't be true. There's two limitations, as they put it. There's two limitations on legislation. First, it can't just be a vote without the governor. The governor has to be involved. And the second is it can't be just the governor acting alone. And I'm quoting now from the opinion. Acting within these constitutional limitations, the legislature may choose any voting scheme that it deems appropriate. And so we're within those guardrails in this proposal. They also said that, to be clear, the issue here is not whether the legislature chose the best voting rule. Rather, the issue is whether the pardon provision prohibits a unanimous vote requirement. So I hope that that makes it clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Osler. So very quickly, I'm partly channeling things I've heard from other members as well. You know, one of the things that, when we talk about the uniqueness of Minnesota, one of the things that stands out in our state is that we have historically skewed away from incarceration. And so there's a different, one could argue, a different culture if you have here. That created some other issues in our probation, supervised release system. But going back to the 30 or 40 a year pardons, it, does that play into that? And then two, if you can just also speak really quickly about, you said that there's, we're seeing a rise in requests, pardon requests, and maybe you can just share a little bit about what you know in Minnesota might be driving that as well.
I'm sorry, with the second question, what's driving, what is
the
it?
The increase in requests.
Okay. Yeah. So just on the first question, Minnesota traditionally is a low incarceration state. We're usually in the bottom five of all states. But we have to remember that when we're talking about clemency in a state like Minnesota, overwhelmingly what we're talking about is pardons, not commutations. And those are two different things. Pardons are for people who have completed their term of service. Commutations are going to shorten the sentence and often let someone out of prison. We have very few commutations, and the mix of applicants is very skewed towards pardons. And so that means that these are people who have completed their term, and sometimes they receive probation. And so they successfully completed the term of probation, but they still have this felony conviction on their record that stops them from doing things. I've made a point of going to all the pardon hearings over the past several years, and the stories are really compelling at those pardon hearings. It's sometimes people who, what they want, they've got a 20 or a 30 year ago crime. And what they want to do is go hunting with their kids or their grandkids. They want to become a volunteer firefighter. And they're barred from it that by that long ago conviction. And so what they want is to get out from under that. So in terms of us being a low incarceration state, what this does is look at the successes often of being low incarceration, because it's people who did no time or a short amount of time and then really thrived and succeeded. And so I hope that makes sense in answering the first point. And remind me again what the second one was, because I got so into that one that I lost track. I think the reason that we're getting more petitions right now is because clemency's been in the news a little bit, that there are people who don't realize there may be a way to do those things, to have access to a better job, to visit relatives who are outside of the country, to hunt with their kids. And just that there's a more awareness that this exists has led more people to apply.
Well, and certainly with the it seems to me anyway, that with the bipartisan worldview out there on this particular issue, that makes sense. We saw a big move of course, you know, 4 years ago under the prior White House administration with the First Step Act that I think really reflects that sort of growing sense of a bipartisan, you know, commitment to, you know, these the importance to our society of these redemptive steps.
And I'd add that one thing that has made a big difference is the example set by people who've received clemency. President Trump granted clemency to a woman named Alice Marie Johnson and then talked about her in the State of the Union. And she's spoken all over the country, including here, about what it meant to her to receive this freedom that she earned through reforming herself while in prison. And I think those high-profile stories that we see, again, across the spectrum, you can see this on, you know, she primarily appeared on Fox News telling that story, that's part of what's inspired people to seek the same for themselves.
Very well. Professor, thank you. If you can stick around a bit, though, we're going to hear from two other testifiers, and I'll open this up for committee questions and comments. Thank you. Next, we have Amber Joachim. I hope I absolutely correct my pronunciation of your last name. If you come forward and give us your name and your testimony, we would greatly appreciate it.
Sure. Well, you did much better than Siri. It is Amber Joachim. So thank you so much for this opportunity to speak to all of you and share my testimony with you all. So to give you a brief history of my background, I had two kids by the age of 18, and when I was 19 years old, I was introduced to methamphetamines, and from there, my life was, for the next 14 years, was a downward spiral. So I ended up writing checks and drug charges and credit card fraud and things like that due to my addiction and hanging out with the wrong crowd. So because of my background in 2015. So I have five grandchildren. The first grandchild ended up in Child Protective Services. And because of that, I was unable to take her into my care versus being, moved around from house to house to house. She did eventually end up being adopted out, which is great, to a phenomenal family. But again, because of my background hindrance at the time, I was unable to step in and be her caretaker. So in 2017, I applied for a pardon, and I was told that it was too early because I had a long probation sentence, and I had to wait, I believe it was the 10-year waiting period afterwards before I could apply for a pardon. In 2009, I went through Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, spent 2 years in that program, which has been very helpful for me in my life because it's how I got to where I'm at today. So in 2017, I applied for a pardon. I found out that I was too early, but I had the opportunity to apply and ask for an early pardon. So I did that, and I was given that opportunity. And I know that not many people get that opportunity to go sit in front of the board pardons and share their experience early, and then not only that, be granted a pardon. So the reason why I wanted to get a pardon is because I wanted to volunteer at my grandkids' schools, and I was denied like three times, and I kept sending letters back to him and saying, I understand my background, but you know, I have 10 years clean at this time or 11 years clean at this time, and this is what I want to do. I want to give back to society. So that was one of the reasons. The other reason is I've had my two grandkids that I have now since they were babies. One is 8, the other is 6, and I want to be able to adopt them. So in order to do that, I cannot have a background. So that was another one of my goals or reasons to want a pardon. Some of the things that I'm doing now, because I was granted that pardon, is, you know, volunteering with 4-H, volunteering at the kids' schools, volunteering in the county jails, giving back as many opportunities that I'm given to give back to people, because I feel like that's my drive in life, is to like help change people's trajectory in life and to be able to do that. I know one of the biggest things for me was, how do I explain that I can't volunteer or ride the bus with my grandchild with a felony on my background because I was denied that opportunity due to my background. So it's really helped me feel free. I mean, I guess feel normal, feel whole. I have some notes here too. The pardon for me was life-changing. Just knowing that I can now pass a background check, it's empowered me to want to be a part of the many opportunities that I can, the ones that I know that I can pass a background check at. And let me see. Gosh, I don't know. I just know that for me, the pardon has been life-changing. And I feel like a productive member of society. I've changed my life. I've given back in so many different ways to the community, and I still do it. But again, I guess being able to pass a background check has been so empowering, and I've really appreciated that opportunity, and I'm so thankful that I was granted that pardon.
Thank you, Ms. Yochim, and it's a powerful testimony about the positive impact, not just on you personally, but on society as well, and So it's empowering for me to hear your life's journey, and I wish you continued success and goodness with that. And hopefully those are opportunities that can broadly exist for others with the same heart as yours. So thank you.
I agree. Thank you so much.
Thank you. If you can stick around for any questions, that'd be wonderful. Next, we have Mr. Tim Marine. If you can come forward and state your name for the record and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Yes, I am Tim Morin. Can you guys hear me all right?
Yes, indeed, sir.
Wonderful. Okay. So good morning, Chairman Mariani and legislatures of the House of Representatives. My name is Tim Morin.
Welcome, Mr. Morin. Please proceed. You might. Oh, there you are. Okay. Are you muted,
baby? Oh, I got that on.
Oh, there we go.
All right. So, sorry about that. I stand before you to discuss Bill 3464. Before I discuss my experiences, I'd like to enlighten you a little bit about the man that I am today.
Deep breaths are good, Mr. Warren. You're doing well.
All right, so today I am a firefighter. I am an EMT. I am a husband of two amazing children. I am a business owner that provides jobs for the community. I told myself I wasn't going to do this.
Quite all right.
I mentor troubled youth, and I speak to youth groups on a regular basis, where my message is, show me your future, or show me your friends and I'll show you your future, and how small decisions can lead to big decisions. I've not only been a law-abiding citizen since my conviction, but I haven't had as much as a speeding ticket in the last 10 years. Excuse me. I have built playgrounds for women's shelters, served for soup kitchens for the homeless, built homes for Habitats for Humanity. I have counseled individuals trying to find their place after time of serving, where they serve time. I received a Chisago County Civilian Life Saving Award in 2018. I am a Good Samaritan. And lastly, I'm a man of faith. So I tell you these things not because I want to boast, but in hopes that you might better understand the type of person that this process is currently failing. So 18 years ago, I made the greatest mistake of my life. I was hanging out with a group of troubled youth at 18 years old. I may have been considered adult, but I sure wasn't mature enough to be considered one. I made a series of poor choices and eventually made one life-changing decision that affected not only myself, but many others. In 2006, I pled guilty to conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery. I do not intend to minimize what happened that night, and no pardon will ever change the way it has permanently affected me. It took me years 14 to be exact, to feel like I was even worthy of pursuing a pardon. Friends and family have pled with me to give me a shot, in which what I would usually reply with, you know, I'll think about it, or I just don't deserve it. So it wasn't until after I received that life-saving award where I'd pulled over and helped a community member in need that I decided maybe I was worth it. See, I didn't just stop for one accident on the road. I stopped for just about anybody that needed it. It just so happened that this one was in far more need than any of the other individuals combined. See, the point is, I wasn't supposed to be in that spot that day with the equipment to use that I had to use to help. And so I took it as a sign, as a second chance. All right. Once I decided to apply for the pardon, I began researching the process. The process is long and grueling. It brought back a lot of hurt and doubt. It began with submitting my driving record, my BCA record, background information, all with stamped seals from the respective departments. Followed with thorough details of my case. Next, I had to provide detailed accounts of what I'd been up to since my release, why I deserved it, or I believe I deserved it, and what I plan to do if granted the pardon. Once that was all submitted, I had to wait in what felt like forever. I received an acceptance letter, which meant I got to meet with the Board of Pardons. The process is difficult. Excuse me, I missed my part there. On that day, I remembered feeling more nervous than the day of my wedding. I checked in and stood in the lobby waiting for the proceedings to begin. I sat as they worked their way case by case until they got to mine. I listened carefully, and feelings of discouragement grew as a few cases prior to mine had a similar detail. A board member spoke up and said, "I do not support this pardon." And just as simple as that, with no regards to the details, it was like the gavel had dropped and he was gone. No further explanation was given. When it came to my turn, I choked out what I tried to draft and make it somewhat audible as emotions came over me. My pastor spoke on my behalf, as did my business partner, both partners, parents of the individual victim in my case, all in support of my pardon. Once that was done, the board members asked me their respective questions. Most of these questions were about what I've done since and my driving record. I answered all the questions and everyone appeared pleased with the answers. It came time to vote, and two out of the three voted to approve my request for pardon. The third member stated the exact same thing as the prior, and it was as it had been said 1,000 times. And again, just like that, the gavel was dropped and it was over. So we made our way out of the courtroom. The victim's family hugged me and said, "I'm sorry it didn't work out." I remember feeling many feelings that day, but one that stood out the most was the feeling that my fate lied in one person's hands. The question I had was, if two out of the three supported me and the victim's family not only supported me, but took the time to show up and speak, doesn't that hold more weight than one person's vote? I proved to two out of the three that changed my life and was worthy of this pardon. Why does my fate, my future, lie in one person's hands who had already made up their mind long before I'd ever, on their vote, long before I'd ever filed for this pardon? This process is difficult, as it should be, and I don't feel many cases are deserving of pardon. I believe this process was intended not to undo the past, but to give hope for the future. When an individual has realigned their life with good choices over the course of a decade. Well, it took myself a long time to forgive myself. I think I am worthy of it. And the process, in the way the current process is functioning, is not serving. I don't believe it's serving as its intended purpose. I ask that you guys support this bill, changing this process of pardons.
Will allow people like myself to get back to the state of Minnesota. That's all I got.
Thank you, Mr. Morin.
I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Please know that this chair, and I suspect all of us here, we see your worth and we see your dignity and we see your goodness. Thank you for being a strong citizen and demonstrating that worth. And I hope that we follow your guidance in terms of expanding hope for the future for many others who are worthy as you. Thank you, sir. With that, that concludes our testimony. I'll open this up for questions and comments. We have some time that we can spend on this. As I said, we won't be voting on this now. We will be moving to lay this over and hopefully and then take action to entertain a motion to bring this bill into our larger bill. Let's begin with Representative Poston. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My question is for the bill author. Representative Long, when I look at the fiscal note number of $687,000, and I look at what that is going to try to buy, it just doesn't seem like enough money to get this done, number one. And number two, if you have this office in place, and you have these six people, what are your expectations as far as pardons going from 40 to what kind of number? Do you have anything, an idea about that?
Very well, thank you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of the fiscal cost, I can only kind of take what was given to us as the estimate for what it would cost. You know, I don't think it would be a ton of staff time and support, but there would be some, which is why the fiscal note is there. And right now, a lot of that work, you know, there isn't the support to do it at the same level. So the goal really is, I think as Professor Osler highlighted, to help make sure that there are more opportunities to be heard, more cases getting processed. It's hard for me to say exactly how many that would lead to. Professor Austin might have a sense from South Dakota or other states, but I will say that the current process of having people have to appear in person before a board of three incredibly busy people makes it really hard to get to the place where you can have the kind of volume to process 200, you know, or so claims a year. And that's a real challenge that we have right now.
Yeah, Representative Long, when I was looking at the fiscal note, it said one attorney, three management analysts, and two support staff, plus an office lease, supplies, computers, software, et cetera. It just doesn't seem like you can get this done for that much money. And, you know, we all know that, you know, attorney is not you know, they're pretty well paid folks, right? And three management people would be pretty well paid folks, I would think. So I'd really encourage you need to look at this number.
Representative Long.
Yep, happy to take a look at it. I it hadn't stood out to me as being unreasonable. I think that level of staffing seems to be, from the folks I've talked to, the appropriate level, and not all attorneys are as highly paid as others. maybe Professor Osler could comment on both of the questions, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair.
Of course, Professor Osler.
Yeah, just in terms of staffing, in 2015, along with a professor at NYU, we created a pop-up law firm where you had some specialists for a year do clemency cases. So a similar job to what this would be. And I know that we were able to attract people to do that who really believed in the work, that it was far less than, they were paid far less than what someone, say a law firm, would be paid. Probably much more in keeping with what a public defender makes. And that does reduce costs quite a bit. The other thing, too, to remember is that right now, part of the problem is that the secretary of the Board of Pardons is the Commissioner of Corrections. And so the people who are doing the legwork right now, it's on borrowed time from the other important work that Corrections has to do.
Very well. And I think Representative Paulson, you might be referring to a fiscal note that might have been prepared last year. So it doesn't make your question any less important. It's an important question. And I think Representative Long, Representative Paulson's kind of trying to throw you a bit of a realistic lifeline in terms of, well, you know, if we're going to do this, let's make sure that we've got the right amount of resources to get it done correctly. So certainly worth, digging into before we bring the bill back up in our omnibus bill construction. Representative Paulson, you're good?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Long, and thank you, Dr. Osler.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Representative Hollins.
Sorry, I had to find my unmute button. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this bill. I'm really excited about this, and I'll tell you why, because I have talked to multiple people who did not know that clemency was an option, and that lack of knowing that this is something that they could do, not to mention the feeling that it is an impossible hurdle to overcome, is really important when we're talking about individuals who may have done something wrong in their past but are working to make it right. And so I think giving people that hope and giving them something to work towards really makes a huge difference in what we see, how we see community members acting, and you know, how they interact with their community and with society in general. And I think it also gets to this fundamental notion of what is our criminal justice system for? Is it purely punitive? Are we hoping to restore individuals? Are we hoping to make them, to bring them back into the fold and have them be working members of society? I think all of that is really important and is really encapsulated by these changes that your bill would make. So that's my first just like, yay, thank you. But my second question, or I guess my actual question, is for Professor Osler. So hello, Professor Osler. I don't know if you remember me. But I would love for you to touch on what kind of outlier Minnesota is compared to other states. And I think you touched on it a bit, but I'd really like to know comparatively, especially compared to states that we're surrounded by, what we look like as far as how difficult it is to achieve clemency. So thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question.
And,
yes, thank you. Yes, I mean, I talked before about South Dakota, and just to circle back to the question that the chair posed before about numbers, we know that South Dakota grants about 70 to 100 a year. And so we would, and of course, that's a smaller state in terms of population as opposed to what we have. So so there's that. And in terms of what we'd be doing with these changes, I think that Representative Collins, we would be focusing, we'd be able to focus on those people who you mentioned, you know, the ones who want to have hope, want to see a change. That those of us that have been in law enforcement, that's what we want is public safety. And part of public safety is letting people like Mr. Moran achieve his goals in a way that is productive for society. And I think this is a move towards that. Now, I think I'm maybe missing the core of your question. So could we go back to that? Could you pose it again?
Representative Holmes?
Yeah, the core of my question is really how does Minnesota compare to other right. Midwestern states?
Yeah, that's right. I just mentioned South Dakota. And other states have different experiences around us. Wisconsin, for example, during the Scott Walker years, the governor has total authority there, but prior governors had relied on an advisory board. Scott Walker shut it down and did not use clemency at all. And then when we saw Governor Evers take over there, he resuscitated the advisory board and has actually used, has come to use clemency quite actively. So Wisconsin's numbers are at least double ours, I believe. When we look at other states, the most productive states include South Carolina, for example, that grants hundreds every year, usually between 300 and 400 a year. And they have a system where they take it out of the governor's hands altogether. They have a board that, under its own authority, makes the decisions that's nominated by the governor and others. So other states that are fairly productive include Delaware, where they have a system that has lower level state officials than we have involved in the decision, and their grant rates are much higher than ours. So when we look at what works, I mentioned Oklahoma already. There's a variety of paths to a good outcome. But where we see things failing is where we have a process that impedes a good outcome. And we heard about that already from the people who have testified. It's really difficult to say there's one method that works and others that don't, because often it depends on who's in office. But generally, when we look at the most productive states, the ones not just that grant a lot, but seem to give fair consideration to clemency and who have good outcomes in terms of avoiding recidivism in people who get a grant, often they have a review board that's bipartisan, that has diverse voices on it. And that's what we're looking to create here.
Okay. Well, thank you, Professor. Members, so I want to get us to the next bell, but we do have two other committee members. So I'm going to call on them, and then we'll move to the next bell. Representative Cleavorn, followed by Representative Johnson. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say to the testifiers, thank you for being here and for sharing your humanity with us. I would say that many of us made choices when we were younger that did not really exemplify our character as adults very well. And I appreciate your willingness to remind us of that today. And I want to just thank Representative Long for bringing the bill forward. It's really important. And I like the idea that we are considering, as our testifier just said, returning productivity for society. You know, there is a great deal of cost to our society when we limit the success and the opportunities of individuals. So I'm just very glad that you were here to remind us that there is redeeming value in humanity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. And as you spoke, I have to admit, I shudder to think some of the things I did when I was a young man. And some of the differences between me and others is that I wasn't quote unquote caught for that. I certainly grew up and became very repentant and learned and did not repeat any of those things. But I suspect that's a common story in our society.
And to that, Mr. Chair, we know so much more about brain development today. So
we certainly do. Thank you, Representative Cleaver. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, Representative Long, I do have some concerns on this bill. One concern is that the way this bill is, the board is not allowed. Let's see, where was it here? The board is not allowed to submit receive statements in this bill from any of the victims or law enforcement. It's concerning because I think the board, once they get the information from this, the pardon board with the governor, the attorney general, and the Supreme Court justice, I think they should have all the information. What law enforcement has to say, the dealings they've had with them, what the victims have to say. I think that is important to make a proper decision. This new board that you're setting up will hear that, but the people who actually make the decision are not going to hear that information. And I'm just wondering if Representative Long could tell me why that those people would be shut out from here being able to actually hear from the actually talk to the three individuals that are going to actually make the decision.
Representative Long, quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, you might be looking at the amendment, but if you look at the actual bill, it does allow for just what you're discussing on lines 5.28 to 5.32. The commission must consider statements by victim or law enforcement when making its recommendations. So those are will in fact be taken into account.
Okay, I do appreciate. I do appreciate that it's a very complex amendment on a very complex bill. Not a complete DE, but really close. So it makes it hard to find everything, and it makes it difficult for the public to understand them, especially on some things this complicated. But I also I want to point out that under the current system we have, the courts have found that it is it does work, and it is working, and it's set up the way it should work with the three individuals. I do know that how the process works. Their legal counsel, whether it's in the AG's office, the governor, or the chief justice, their legal counsel goes through these, looks at them, studies them, finds out the information, and gives good information to each one of them, and they combine all three when they go to the board. So they can discuss it. They don't have just one outlook of, or the person of one. It's the work of all three areas that are giving them the information so that a proper decision can be made. Our system appears to be working fine, and it's important that, and in this bill, it takes it from unanimous to just two out of the three. I do have concerns with that as well, because I think this is important that everybody agrees, not just a consensus or majority rule, because then it would be up to, it'd politicize it even more. Where with all three of them have to agree, it makes it better. Also, Chair Mariani, in line 7.26, this board, review board that's going to be set up, they're going to be making their own rules. With that, this bill does need to go to state government finance at some point to be discussed, because it does have rulemaking authority. Also, I want to thank Mr. Evans for being here. He's been through a lot, but it also shows that our system does work, because it did work for him. He showed and proved that he deserved it. And I think that's one thing that's important. It shouldn't be given just randomly. These individuals that are seeking this should be able to prove that they deserve it. So with that, I will end my remarks there.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Long, why don't you close this out, then we'll move on to your other bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I did want to just respectfully disagree with Representative Johnson that the current process is working. I think we've heard that we are a real outlier as a state in requiring three unanimous votes. And Mr. Morin, I think, gave a really powerful and moving example of why this doesn't work, which is that he was able to persuade two of three people, but because he wasn't able to persuade the third person, he was not granted a pardon. So that's a very high bar and not one that many other states follow. So I just wanted to thank Tim and Amber very much for their personal and moving testimony, and thank the committee for their time today.
Thank you, Representative Law. And I too want to again extend my gratitude to Tim and to Amber. We're real privileged that you were with us here today to share your story. We wish you both much success and goodness in your lives going forward. With that, members, the chair will The chair moves, or rather, the chair lays over House File 3464 as a member for as amended for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Members, next we have House File 1152. Representative Long moves to refer House File 1152 to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Long, to your bill, it's before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a DE amendment for this one that I'd like to offer this time.
Representative Long moves the DE2 amendment. Representative Long, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amendment that would incorporate a number of the changes that we've worked on in the past year to get the bill in the shape I'd like the committee to hear.
All right, Representative Johnson, it looks like the motion to shape up the bill in the form that the author wishes for us to act. Are you okay with a voice vote?
That is fine.
Very well, thank you, sir. All in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 1152, as amended, is before us. Representative Long, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. We did hear this bill last year, but I'll try to refresh members' recollection about what the bill does and then mention a couple of the updates before we get to our testifiers. The Clean Slate Act bill has a simple premise, which is that we should give those who have paid their debt to society an opportunity for redemption. Too often, having a criminal record severely limits an individual's opportunities to find jobs, housing, or education. And I know I've heard from many constituents individually who are trying to turn their lives around, but are really struggling to find a job because of the barrier posed by their record. We are currently facing a workforce shortage crisis in Minnesota. According to Deed, job vacancies are the highest they've been in 20 years, and this is particularly true in greater Minnesota. 1 in 4 Minnesotans have some type of criminal record, and 90% of employers conduct background checks. So this adds up to being a really significant barrier to employment for tens of thousands of Minnesotans. The Clean Slate Act is similar to broad bipartisan efforts we've seen around the country in states like Utah, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. In Michigan, those who had their records expunged saw their average wages increase by 25%. This bill also builds on the leadership many of our county attorneys are currently showing in expunging old records, but not all counties have the same resources to pursue this. So there have been regional inequities in terms of which counties are able to move forward with expungements that are prosecutor initiated. So the updates that we've made, the Clean Slate Act would automatically expunge records for certain misdemeanors after a crime-free waiting period. We have made a big change from last year in that we removed the list of eligible felonies that were in last year's bill, so we're only focusing on misdemeanors. We have a long list of excluded crimes, including all enhanceable offenses and criminal sexual conduct offenses. We also worked very diligently with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to get all of the technical details right. And I want to thank Ben Johnson, our House researcher, and the BCA staff for their tireless efforts to try to make sure that this is very implementable and can be streamlined when hopefully passed. We also, I should mention, retained a number of the important protections that were in the original draft, including allowing the continued access by law enforcement and DHS to records, so this won't affect any background checks that are done by DHS for jobs for which those are required. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have our testifiers present.
Very well. There are 4 testifiers. I'll call on them. I will ask them to please be concise and, of course, powerful in their testimony. First, we have Judge Bob Spall, Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Judge Spall, always good to see you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I am the Executive Director of the County Attorneys Association. I wanted to first, and I'll be concise, thank Representative Long for all his hard work and working with a number of people who are interested in this bill, getting it in the shape that Representative Long wants it. I just wanted to mention that the County Attorneys Association supports this bill, and I'll end it there. And Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Jorge Sabata is here for, he and I will stand for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you, Judge Small. Next, we have Grace Walsh, Vice President of of Public Policy for the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. Welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Long, and members of the committee. My name is Grace Waltz, and I serve as Vice President of Public Policy at the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. And I'm here to testify in support of House File 1152, the Clean Slate Act. As an organization representing nearly 2,300 employers across the greater metropolitan region, we know the importance of having trained and skilled workers. As we continue to grapple with the unprecedented worker shortage, that need is more important than ever. We believe this legislation will help provide a pathway for workers to help fill this void. Unfortunately, there are many barriers for individuals with criminal records who seek to better their lives but face barriers in education, housing, and employment. According to the Brennan Center, the number of Americans with a criminal history has increased significantly over the past 30 years. Today, nearly one-third of working adults have a criminal record. Our country now has roughly the same number of people with criminal records as they do with college degrees. These numbers do not include people who were arrested but never charged or individuals who were acquitted. As we look to our workforce in the next decade, employers need trained and skilled workers. When we testified in support of this legislation a year ago, we spoke of the worker shortage that was bound to continue even in a post-pandemic world. We now know that shortage is worse than anyone could have anticipated. Employers are looking for creative solutions, and this legislation provides a much needed opportunity to expand our talent pool. This bill will allow a pathway for individuals to receive automatic expungements for certain convictions while still maintaining public safety access to those records. This will make an enormous difference for individuals who are seeking to enroll in post-secondary education options, training programs, obtain occupational licenses, and secure stable housing. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide our support for this important legislation, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. Thank you for helping to place the context of our big overall demographic shift-induced stresses on our economy and on our society. Please stick around for questions. With that, we now have Joanne Kaufman of the Warehouse District Business Association. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joanne Kaufman, and I serve as Executive Director of the Warehouse District Business Association. I'm testifying today in support of House File 1152, the Clean Slate Act. As you know, small businesses across the region have had a very difficult past couple of years. In particular, many of the bars, restaurants, and hospitality venues we represent have had an extremely tough time finding staff as they work to rebuild their businesses. This legislation is an important major step to bringing more people back into the workforce in a thoughtful and careful manner. Today's amendment applies lessons learned from other states and narrows the number of qualifying offenses for automatic expungement. Importantly, it has an automatic process, avoiding the need for a court petition. Since 2018, five states have enacted an automatic expungement system: Pennsylvania, Utah, Michigan, Connecticut, and Delaware. We believe Minnesota should be next. The act of wiping the slate clean for impacted Minnesotans will likely help provide extra encouragement to seek employment. Helping every Minnesotan who wants a job find a job should be one of our goals. The employers of the Warehouse District Business Association believe that helping individuals find a better path for education, training, housing, and jobs will help create a stronger Minnesota for all of us. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share a perspective on this important legislation, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kaufman. I'm writing furiously my notes here. Pennsylvania, Utah, Michigan, Delaware. What was the other state?
Pennsylvania, Utah, Michigan, Connecticut, and Delaware.
Connecticut. All right. Very well. Thank you. Please stick around for questions.
Absolutely.
And next we have Chaz Anderson of the Justice Action Network. It's really good to see you, Chaz. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I'm here, obviously, to speak and provide testimony today on House File 1152. For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, and I'm here representing the Justice Action Network. The Justice Action Network is the nation's largest bipartisan criminal justice organization, working at the federal level and in over 20 states, including in Minnesota since 2016. During the past year, the author of the bill worked with stakeholders like the Justice Action Network and the county attorneys to resolve some outstanding issues that were brought up during the 2021 legislative session, including the work of automating records, automatically expunging records. Stepping back, we looked at the lessons learned in early adopter states of Pennsylvania and Utah. And both of those states worked very hard on ensuring that there was a workable process in place to automate records. And therefore, they started out with automation with lower level offenses first. And that's really the approach we're taking in the amendment that was adopted today and as described by Representative Long. I know that the other testifiers have provided background information, and so has Representative Long, but I'll just add this to the what's been said today. Lastly, the research shows that the cumbersome petition-driven system really does fail to provide relief as they intend to do when they pass legislation. A 2019 study in Michigan found that just 6.5% of eligible people obtained expungement within 5 years of eligibility through the petition-based process. That's why, to address this shortcoming, at least five other states and a dozen states right now are considering legislation to enact an automated expungement system for certain offenses. We mentioned those five states that have already adopted legislation: Pennsylvania, Utah, Michigan, and Connecticut, and Delaware. And other states, as I said, like Minnesota, are considering legislation this year. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to stay and answer any questions members may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Representative Long, that's what I have for testifiers. So let's open this up for questions and comments from the committee members. We'll begin with Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, I'm just really curious. I don't see anyone on the testifier list from victims. So like Violence Free Minnesota, Mincasa, maybe even from the sheriffs or the Chief of Police Association, or do you have any feedback from them? Were they involved in the process? Were they part of the stakeholder process? You know, I appreciate that the county attorneys are here and they're a piece of it, but I'm just curious what their voice are saying.
Very well, Representative Long.
Thank you so much for the question, Representative O'Neill. So over the past couple of years, we've had lots of conversations with victims groups. We didn't really change the victim notification provisions that are in the bill from last year. So there still would be the notice requirement for victims in the bill as it is currently. And I was given a limited number of testifier slots. But if there are certainly any questions that folks have from the victim community, we're happy to engage. I haven't heard concerns from the changes that were made from the draft last year.
And Representative Long, so part of what you're telling us is that last year there was some interactions with groups representing survivors and victims.
Yes, Mr. Chair, precisely. We had many conversations with victims groups consulting on the base text that this bill is working off of.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Long. I think from my comfort level, if you had even just a letter of support or something from Violence Free Minnesota, Mincasa, sheriffs, you know, somebody that's sort of on the other side of this, that representing the victims, that would be a little bit more comfort to me. I'm always concerned when the victims are not in the committee to voice their support if they support. So that's always a question for me, and maybe they could just do it in writing. That would be helpful. And I'm sure I'll look at my phone. I'll probably be getting text messages as I say this from some of those folks. But of course, that's incredibly important to me. As you know, I care about balance, but I very much care about protecting victims from additional violence. And I do see that you've left gross misdemeanors in and felonies have been taken out. And I would just be concerned that victims would be impacted. And since we didn't have a victim to talk about that, that's why I asked that. So, as this moves on, if you would include that testimony, that'd be super helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Raleigh.
Mr. Chair, could I
respond? Yes, of course. I'm sorry.
No problem. Yes, Representative O'Neill, I'd be happy to reach out to those organizations. And I did also just want to note that all criminal sexual conduct cases are not eligible for expungement automatically. So some of the cases that those particular organizations you mentioned might be concerned with are not going to be automatically expungible.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question I've got is, I'm not sure I'm following two parts of it. One of them is on 116, the eligibility for the duration of stay. A person is eligible for a grant of expungement if they've successfully completed the terms of the diversion. And then it goes on to say on line 2.4 that they've not been convicted of a new offense other than an offense that would be a petty misdemeanor in Minnesota during the applicable waiting period immediately following the discharge. So to the author, Mr. Chair, can you walk me through kind of what that timeline looks like? Because I know that there's going to be a period where they're serving the sentence, and then there's a period of the delinquency proceedings, and then they're eligible, and then there is a waiting period. And I'm just not able to tie those together to understand what that periods, look like. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't pull up my draft quick enough. I'm wondering if Mr. Johnson might be able to walk through if he was following.
Mr. Ben Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, Representative Long, there are a few different options. I just want to be clear. The first piece that Representative Raleigh mentioned is in Subdivision 2. That applies to people who are not convicted. They've received either a diversion or a stay of adjudication. If that is the case, they receive one of those two things, then the waiting period is 1 year. So they would complete the terms of the diversion program or the stay of adjudication, and then it would be a 1 year waiting period for those individuals, and they would need to be not charged or convicted of a new offense. That's in the language at 118 and 119. Subdivision 3 applies to individuals who have been convicted or adjudicated. And in that situation, it's the waiting period depends on the level of the conviction. You have to look down after all of the exclusions to find the waiting period. The applicable waiting period is defined. It's at page 3 from lines 15 through 17. If it's a petty misdemeanor or a misdemeanor, the waiting period is 2 years. If it's a gross misdemeanor, the waiting period is 4 years. I think that responds to the questions. Yeah. I hope that's helpful.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's exactly what I was looking for. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. And that's the purpose of committee hearings, is to have that kind of clarification. So I appreciate your line of questioning, Representative Raleigh. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Long. Again, I have a couple minor concerns on this bill. But first, I have a question for two of the testifiers, two different questions. First would be to the chamber, Ms. Walls. One of the issues that a lot of businesses have is their liability insurance. A lot of this information that's going to be expunged is available to the public in newspapers and everything else. But if they go by, and they know there's somebody that is involved in thefts and identity thefts and other type of issues, minor assaults. But the record has been expunged, so when you do the records check for employment or even possibility for housing in that area, you do the official check through the BCA, and that person ends up doing something. The insurance companies are real concerned about those issues, and I'm just wondering how that could impact your business with the insurance rates going up to the point where it could cost the businesses or being totally dropped so they could not be in business. Do you have any concerns with that?
Ms. Waltz, are you still with us?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question. We understand the question, and I think that is something that comes to mind for business owners. And we'd be happy to discuss this further to answer some of those questions as well. But I think one of the primary reasons that we have been supportive of this bill last year and this year is because one of what we are hearing from a lot of employers is they will have candidates come along who they think will be really excellent fits for the job, and they're in desperate need of those workers. And then they see that criminal history. And even if they don't feel that that criminal history would impact their ability to do the job or be a trusted employee, they feel, I think for those concerns, they feel obligated to not hire that person. So I think that is something that is top of mind for folks, and we'll be happy to go into those details a little more. And we've been in discussion with Representative Long about this as well.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Ms. Walsh, thank you for that. And this bill shows the dire need that this state needs to do in tort reform. That's one thing that has to go along with something like this, especially for business insurance. My father-in-law has a business where we actually have to look at that stuff along with my wife in a different business she's involved at, because it can affect the insurance rates to the point where the company might not be able to get insurance or liability insurance or anything like that. So it's something that's got to be discussed hand in hand with something like this. I also have a question for the County Attorney's Association, Judge Small. And that would be, we got other states that have enacted some of this automatic expungement. In Minnesota, we have, in domestic assault, we have aggravating factors. In fact, to the point where you don't have to be convicted. It's to the point where there's a pattern of this. Now, you take another state that is doing these expungements automatically, and you don't know that a person might have a couple different offenses in a couple different states that have been expunged that would create an aggravating factor here in Minnesota. Is there any way that without calling each individual state that has this, checking their, to have them check their records to find out for possible aggravating factors in your charging decisions when it could be a domestic assault or something like that?
Judge Smalls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, and I might have to defer to Jorge, but I think the bill allows for access to at least the expunged records for county attorneys, and that they can be used for enhancement purposes. Your question about, finding out about convictions or potential expungements in other states, I am sorry, Representative Johnson, I do not have an answer to that question, and perhaps Assistant Ramsey County Attorney can help me out there.
Thank you, Judge Small.
Jorge.
I was reaching around for the name. Mr. Saavedra, welcome to the committee. If you can weigh in and be as brief as possible, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Johnson. A couple of things on that question. First of all, assault offenses, domestic violence offenses, enhanceable offenses, and generally person offenses are exempted. They are not eligible for automatic expungement under this bill. And more directly to Representative Johnson's question, for law enforcement and for prosecutors. So for purposes of looking at a person's criminal history or looking at prior and offenses for the purpose of enhancement of new offenses, access to these records for law enforcement and for prosecutors is as if the expungement never happened. So it's completely transparent for law enforcement and for prosecutors. And that's also true in terms of what appears on a national criminal history. So currently, I can request from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension a Minnesota and a national criminal history, and automatically expunged offenses would appear on that criminal history for an individual. So I would be able to see both any Minnesota prior offenses and the full criminal history, and as well as the full criminal history of that individual in any other state in the country.
Powerful transparency. And Mr. Savannah, I apologize. I should have asked you to state your name for the record. So if you do that really quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Mariani, thank you. My name is Jorge Saavedra, and I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Representative Johnson.
I appreciate that information. It is helpful. These are things that we need to look at to make sure that the victims are protected, but also those who commit violent crime are also held accountable. The other question I have is for Representative Long on 2.4 and 2.6. As far as the expungement goes, it says is not charged with an offense in Minnesota on both lines. We have a lot of border communities, and we are a transient a world. We have incidences that occur on airplanes. We have untrained all over this country. We have border communities where, I'll take Taylor's Falls, for example. In order to buy groceries, you go to, if you live in Taylor's Falls, the closest place to buy groceries is less than a mile away in Wisconsin. And if it happens there, the way this bill is written, so I hope you'll clean this up, is if an offense would have happened in Wisconsin, it would have made no effect on the automatic expungement in Minnesota because it says is not charged with an offense in Minnesota at the time reaches the end of his applicable waiting period. So he could do anything in any other of the 49 states in this United States or any other country, but he'd still get the expungement automatically because the offense did not occur in Minnesota. I know this bill is being referred to judiciary. Hopefully it'll get, some of these concerns will get fixed. But until we start working about tort reform and dealing with that issue, I have a tough time supporting this.
Very well. Representative Long, I'll have you respond. We are about to run into the witching hour of noon. We have a rule here in the House during this period of time not to conduct business beyond noon. It's also my understanding, my staff has been checking with judiciary. It does not look like judiciary needs or desires to have this bill. So I'm going to keep this bill here. That will give us an opportunity to do some of the things that some of the members have raised questions, so we can revisit it here at a later time. So I'm going to be laying your bill over. Representative Grass, I see your name is up. Your hand is up. We're not going to have time, sir. It's the rules of the House. So I'm going to have Representative Long respond, give some thoughts, closing thoughts. Momentary closing thoughts, because we'll come back to that. Then the chair's definitely of this bill over. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, so to your point on liability, good news, Minnesota Statute 181.981 does provide some protection for employers who are following expungement statutes from liability. So I think that will be solved once we have the expungement, this expungement updated. In terms of your question about the Minnesota, in Minnesota requirement, in our previous version, when we had felonies, we did require an out-of-state look, but that resulted in a very large fiscal note, and we've dropped felonies. So at this point, we are only looking at misdemeanors, low-level crimes, and we have a very long list of exclusions, as Mr. Saavedra noted. And so we are just focusing on in Minnesota crimes for that that waiting period of 4 years.
Very well, Representative Long, final thoughts before Chair lays your bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to take a minute to thank the really large group of organizations and individuals who have worked very hard on this bill over many years to support this. The County Attorneys Association, who poured in many hours, the Justice Action Network, who worked really hard, and the business community, who provided their support. I think that this bill is bipartisan, has very strong support from across the community, and is a really common sense way to help make sure that we are giving people second chances and that we're giving employers in particular the comfort that they need to hire individuals who they want to hire who otherwise would have been screened out. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Long, I too join your appreciation to all the folks you've worked with. Sometimes bills take a long time, but that just means that we craft much better legislation. Thank you to all the testifiers here today. The chair moves, or rather the chair lays over House File 1152 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, bring your snacks, some good water, comfortable seating pad for next Tuesday. It'll be a two-part session, but I think it's going to be a rich conversation for us as we do the good work here at the Minnesota House of Representatives. Wishing everyone a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you all next week. This committee stands adjourned.